KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in the second hour of Forum, the subject is power, who has it and how it affects those who do and don't, and why it's important in nearly all human relationships. We'll have a panel of experts as well as your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. That famous assessment on power by Lord Acton is one of the perennial lessons that many cite when they're talking about power. And of course, there's Henry Kissinger's remark that power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. Any way you want to look at it, power reigns in the corporate and romantic worlds, and researchers tell us nearly in all human relationships. And in this hour, we thought we'd talk about power with some who have been studying it and find out what we can about it. Let me tell you who is joining us here in studio for the hour. I want to welcome first Cameron Anderson, is professor of organizational behavior and industrial relations at the Haas School of Business, UC Berkeley. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here, and also glad to have Deborah Grunfeld, who is professor of organizational behavior and a social psychologist in the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. Good morning.
Morning.
And also with us is Dacher Keltner, a professor in the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley, and welcome, Dacher Keltner.
Thank you.
Glad to have all you power brokers here. And Cameron Anderson, I think let us begin with you, because you've actually gone through five studies, and people will be, I think, particularly interested to learn that what these studies seem to show, that those who have power are a lot more, well, optimistic about all kinds of things. In fact, probably much more apt to take risks and much more apt to think that they are maybe Teflonish when it comes to risks.
That's right. So a colleague of mine, Adam Galinsky, and I,
He's at Northwestern,
exactly. We conducted a number of studies where we're testing the basic idea that people in power were more optimistic when estimating the chances of risks paying off in a number of different ways. So we looked at business decisions, we made at private decisions, we kind of looked at all kinds of things. And we found very consistent evidence that when people have power, or when they're just made to feel power, sort of powerful temporarily, they tend to view the world much more optimistically, sort of with rosy-colored glasses.
So power does go to the head, then, as the old cliche would
absolutely,
have it.
Absolutely.
That seems to be one of the examples that you cite would be, let's say, someone like Bill Clinton thinking that with Monica Lewinsky, nothing is going to go wrong or
that's
nothing
right.
can happen.
That's right. So we even, I think it was the Lewinsky scandal that inspired one study where we were looking at the effects of power on sort of risky sexual behavior, and we found that, you know, even making people feel very sort of minor amounts of power would make them much more likely to engage in risky sexual behavior. So even minor amounts of power can have a pretty profound effect on their behavior.
These were studies done mainly with students, though, weren't they?
Yeah, for the most part, we were looking at undergrads so that we could manipulate their mindset within the laboratory sort of in very controlled ways.
You will admit that publicly, that you're manipulating the minds of undergraduates even though you're teaching them. No, but let me just follow this through for a moment, because how does this apply, for example, to business, to the whole world of business, when you're working with undergraduates?
Well, so now we're doing some follow-up studies with people in the business world, and the basic idea is that when people do have a certain amount of power in the business world, and they have power over other people, and it does go to their head, then this can affect the way they make very important decisions for their businesses and very important decisions for broader collectives. So it's just good to be aware of these biases so that when they're potentially going to engage in some kind of merger or acquisition or some really important decision for the company, you know, that they won't go down the wrong path simply because they're sort of awash in this power.
This is what you call the approach inhibition to power?
That's right. So so Dacher and Deb and I worked on a paper, boy, a few years ago now. And the basic idea, and I'll let Dacher expand on this much more, but the basic idea being that, you know, power activates this behavioral approach system, which in turn makes people much more attuned to the rewards and opportunities around them and much less attuned to some of the potential threats and downsides.
But it has a lot, Dacher Keltner, to do with how people respond to power too, doesn't it? I mean, the fact is that somebody's in a position of power, top of the hierarchy, CEO, whatever, and people respond to that position.
Right. I mean, I think that was one of the important points of our theory, which is that once any kind of individual, once in a position of power, is likely to do the kind of things that Cameron is talking about, be more optimistic, more likely to approach their goals and rewards. And then we were also interested in the darker side to power, which you alluded to in your quote at the outset of the program, which is being optimistic and moving towards our goals. We often fail to attend carefully to other people around us. We suffer deficits in empathy and understanding of others.
Those in power almost tend to be much more objectifying of other human beings under them and less empathic.
Yeah, there are several studies that show that you take a random individual and you put them into a position of power, and they tend to see other people as sort of an object of their own desire or means to their ends. So
the cookie test being sort of a yardstick here for us. Huh?
Yeah, are you talking about my cookie study?
Yeah,
on this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we
explain to our listeners what that is.
Well, this came out of just informal observations of people in power, how they tend to, you know, at the societal level, one worries they take too much of collective resources. In our own face-to-face encounters with our graduate advisors and the like, we'd notice they would perhaps eat off our plates. And so we did a study where we had three people. They came to the laboratory. They engaged in this long study of writing policy recommendations for a university. And one of the participants was given power. In the middle of the study, we presented a plate of five cookies. Now, it's nice because everybody gets to take one cookie. There's a human universal, which is you're going to be polite and leave one cookie on the plate. And so that left one precious cookie for one participant to take. And we found our high power people were more likely to take the cookie. And then perhaps more unsettling was as they ate the cookie and we coded their behavior on their videotapes, they were smacking their lips and crumbs fell all over their shirts. And so it was a nice testimony to the disinhibition of power.
Sounds like Cookie Monster, you know, or something along those lines. You also have studied sort of the way that people maintain power, which is kind of fascinating, that when people get power, it's more necessary in terms of preserving it to use social skills, to be able to negotiate. In fact, we'll talk with Deborah about this, who's done a lot of work on the need to negotiate and work in a team spirit and all that sort of thing. But the more power there is, it seems, the less empathy, and so the less able people are to work in that capacity.
Well, this is one of the great tensions in this research, which is that when you study the higher primates and then you move into humans, this stereotype of power being about alpha male or alpha female assertion is really wrong. And what we're finding is that power really requires very labor-intensive, costly social intelligence. You have to negotiate conflicts amongst subordinates. You have to make sure the allocation of resources is fair. So
this is all Danny Goleman territory.
Right, and Franz De Waal and others. Yeah. And so power really requires a deep emotional intelligence. And then our theory is saying that once in a position of power, the seduction of power really countervails that intelligence. We act impulsively and don't attend carefully to others. So that's the burden of being in power. And one of the things that Cameron and I teach executives is to really maintain the trust and respect of your subordinates, you have to develop emotional intelligence. It's part of stable power.
Well, there is a new book out about 48 laws of power. In fact, the author was featured in The New Yorker. Goes very against this notion. It's sort of more the old Darwinian idea of, you know, you have to topple others and claw your way and dog eat dog and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I you know, that's a Machiavellian view of power, and I think it's antiquated and it's outdated. I think when you look at the complexity of social networks and humans, just the opposite is true. I mean, that 48 Laws of Power argues that you don't trust your subordinates, you pit them against one another, you crush your subordinates mercilessly. And our studies suggest something else is required, a little bit more intelligence and negotiation.
Thacker Keltner is professor of Department of Psychology, UC Berkeley, and Deborah Grunfeld is professor of organizational behavior and social psychologist at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. And this pretty much dovetails with a lot of your work. I mean, especially when you look at the Supreme Court, there seems to be a kind of paradigm there that when you have a minority opinion, it's stronger in some ways, and that allows for better distribution of power.
Yeah, I think that's what our research shows, actually, that we found when Supreme Court justices were in unanimous in their decisions or in a very large majority, they and had more power. As a consequence, they were just more single-minded in their reasoning and not as careful to look at all of the potential consequences of the principles that they were using. And that what we saw is as minority factions became more powerful, there was a kind of tempered quality that came with the reasoning as a consequence. So consistent with what we're talking about, you see also consequences just in the ways that people reason as a consequence of their power, that being very focused on goals, being very approach-oriented does lead to this kind of single-mindedness with regard to pursuit of goals. And you can sometimes lose sight of some of the more subtle subtle implications.
Disinhibition is the word I keep coming across in your research and in the work of those who are here. That is more action orientation with power, but less self-regulation, something along those lines?
Yeah, the idea really is that, you know, if you sort of think of most of us in situations where we don't have a lot of power, there's a sense that we walk around trying to balance our internal drives and motives against what we think the consequences of acting on them would be. So we tend to control and regulate our behavior in social interactions. And our sense when we started to work on this topic, and as we've seen in a lot of studies now, is that when you experience power, find yourself in a situation where you have power, you really stop trying to regulate. There's a tendency to pay less attention to social consequences and to worry less about them. And so you get this very direct connection between people's desires and motives and the acts that would satisfy them.
Except the notion is that those who are power hungry are more driven somehow. They're more willing to take risk. I mean, that's the kind of stereotypical notion. You're saying no.
I think that's right. Well, our work has not looked as much at individuals and their drive for power. We've really been focused more on it. It is kind of an interesting distinction, this idea that, and I think you can get this from the more Machiavellian views as well, that there are specific kinds of people who desire power and have a drive for power, and that's what would lead to the kinds of behaviors that we're describing. And what we believe is something quite different, which is that most of us, whether we desire power or don't desire power, find ourselves in situations where we have it. And then this affects our behavior in ways that are really unintentional and often not conscious. So it's a very different way of thinking about what power is and why it has the effects that we've observed.
But isn't it, well, maybe too conventional a way of looking at power, but isn't it sort of prima facie the idea that those who are driven to seek power, I mean, think about the tyrants and, you know, despots and all that, are maybe the ones who are more aggressive and more resourceful and have more ingenuity and more charisma, more canniness, really?
Huh? I think all of those things are possible. One of the interesting things that we have seen in research is that when you look at the effects of people behaving in disinhibited ways, that at least in our Western culture and parts of it that we're most familiar with, that often is associated with gaining power as well. So you'll find that people who, particularly certain kinds of people who behave in disinhibited ways, often have power attributed to them. So it can really become a kind of a vicious or virtuous cycle, depending on how you think about it. But yes, I think that's right. These kinds of behaviors, being willing to act on one's impulses without worrying too much about social convention and norms, is, I think, quite clearly associated with moving more quickly into positions of power. And we do know also, based on research, that one of the strongest determinants of power is a strong motive for it.
Deborah Grunfeld, again, is professor of organizational behavior and a sociopsychologist in the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. Talk about your letter E experiment, because this dovetails back with what we heard before from Dr. Keltner about less empathy, those
in
power.
Yeah, this is a really important effect, I think. One of the experiments that we conducted in a study, again, with Adam Galinsky at Northwestern and another colleague, Joe McGee at New York University, looked at the effects of power on the ability or tendency to take another person's perspective. And we always had a sense that part of this psychology of power that was associated with being very goal-focused was the kind of tendency for a tendency to stop paying attention to others' experiences. So in this experiment, what we did is we put people into conditions of power or a control condition and then asked them as a series of other tasks to draw a capital E on their forehead with a wash-off Crayola marker. And we also videotaped these activities. And what we saw is that under conditions of power, people were much more likely to draw the E in a direction that was legible to themselves from their own perspective, but illegible to an audience. So if you think about the task of drawing a capital E on your forehead, it's interesting. You can sort of draw the E with the legs pointing to the, this is going to be hard to convey in language, but you can really, you can draw it either facing forward or facing backward, right? And in either condition, it's either legible to the self or legible to an observer. And what we found is that under conditions of power, there was a greater tendency to draw the E so that it was legible to the self and not to an observer. Under control conditions, people were more likely to draw the E backward, that is backward for them, the idea being that
they're dyslexic, possibly.
Yeah. It's possible. We try to control for that kind of thing.
But the sense is, again, here that there's less awareness of the other.
That's right.
That's kind of the bottom line. Now, let's go back to Dacher Keltner, who's talked about this in terms of relationships, romantic relationships. I mean, there's probably a gender split, one would concede, in terms of those who have power and those who don't have power. We're talking about heterosexual relationships, but in any relationships. How do you determine this kind of nature of power in, say, love or romantic relationships?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the important parts of our thinking in this realm, is that we wanted to take power out of the political realm and extend it to romantic relationships, friendships, dynamics between a two-year-old child and mom or dad. And we think power is present in all of them. And we really think about it as the capacity to influence the state of another individual through the provision of resources or punishment. So it's a general phenomenon. And the amazing thing is that by thinking about how power influences really the nervous system, the brain and the autonomic nervous system, our thinking about power suggests that these ideas of disinhibition and the lack of empathy and impulsive behavior that Cameron and Deb have talked about really apply to all different kinds of relationships. So the finding that Deb was talking about, how power really reduces the capacity for empathy. You see that in romantic partners who feel they have more influence over their partner, i.e. power, are less empathetic and judge their partner's emotions less accurately. One of my favorite findings on this comes out of the sibling relationship. Older siblings, these are young kids, 5 and 3 years old, who you would think of along several criteria have more power over their younger sibling, are less able to empathize and to project into the mind of their younger sibling. So we think
this is why your former colleague at Berkeley, Frank Soloway, says that younger siblings are more rebellious.
Exactly.
Because of that.
Exactly.
But, I keep thinking about Michel Foucault, who did such amazing analysis where power relationships are concerned, and who really saw them as the base of all relationships.
Yeah.
That's really what you're saying here, isn't it? That it spreads out. And the idea is having control over someone, whether it's being the employer, whether it's being the lover, whether it's being the friend, the sibling, whatever.
Yeah, and Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, said, as energy is to physics, the basic force, right, that drives the relationships between objects, power is really one of the basic forces, and probably the other is affiliation or warmth between human beings.
You want to move more toward the latter here.
Yeah. But, Foucault was interesting for us because he had this idea about knowledge being a very fundamental source of power and really broadened out social scientific thinking about the sources of power in a rightful way.
I believed that for years. Now I don't anymore. Because I'm trying to acquire knowledge for a whole lifetime. It doesn't necessarily bring power, alas. Cameron Anderson, but what power does bring is a sense of, I guess from reading from your research, from the research that all of you have done, an illusory sense. It's a kind of, in some instances, maybe almost delusional sense of what one can do and what one has possesses the ability to do.
That's right, yeah. So, I think we've kind of touched on that subject in a number of ways. Probably the most direct way is in one study we were looking at how people who were made to feel powerful saw the world in general in terms of things that they could control and things that they couldn't control. And I guess somewhat predictably, people who were made to feel powerful, who had a high sense of power just in general, had a very high sense of control over events that were just immediately around them, things that they actually did perhaps have control over. But then at the same time, they had an enormous sense of control over things that were just random chance, things that they would have absolutely no control over. So encountering turbulence in an airplane or tornadoes or, just natural occurrences, they thought, I'm less likely to encounter these things. And at the same time, they're sort of in control of everything around them, everything in their environment that sort of touched them.
So, Professor Grunfeld, there's a sense of overestimating not only success, but the likelihood of success for those in power.
I think that's true. In fact, there is some research that I'm doing now with a doctoral student at Stanford, Nate Fass, that looks very directly at this question. It's really a follow-on to what Cameron's talking about. And what we've seen in some of our experiments, consistent with Cameron, what Cameron is just saying, is that there is this sense of control that comes with power, and that, and we've shown, you know, very directly that it is an illusion of control. So there's a sense of control that comes with events that should be under the control of the power holder, but that it kind of leaks out into situations where the power holder actually has no control, and does lead people to overestimate their success in situations that they actually don't have any control over, many of which are quite random.
Like our nation's chief executive saying, "I'm the decider."
Yeah.
Something along those lines. Uh-huh. But you're also implying that decisions are better made when they're made in a teamwork fashion than top down. And of course, there are many who would say, boy, you know, thank heavens we got this person on the top, because mm-hmm. he can make decisions much better, much faster, much more efficiently than the rest of us.
It depends on how you value those trade-offs, I think. I mean, you know, we're talking about power and the consequences of power in a kind of a negative way, and I think that doesn't really convey the whole picture in terms of what we believe is going on. Power is important, and hierarchy is very important for many reasons, and efficiency is one of them. So it's necessary to have hierarchy in situations where decisions need to be made quickly, with confidence, and in particular in which you need to have other people implement those decisions. It's important to have a powerful person at the top, but there are trade-offs in terms of often the quality of the decision. So again, you don't get as many perspectives brought to bear on a problem when one person is making the decision on their own. And the idea of using teams to make decisions, we've known this for a long time, just is just a way of trying to ensure that there are checks and balances in the process, and trying to ensure that more than one perspective is being brought to bear, so that it's possible to anticipate all different kinds of consequences.
I'm sensing, though, from reading your works, that you do think that there's a very strong link between the abuse of power and lack of empathy. Which would make sense, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
That's underlying a lot of where you're going, it seems to me, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of the, you know, the abuse of power. Well, there are a lot of findings in the literature that say that people who feel a lot of power abuse it. And there are documented relationships between feeling powerful and inappropriate sexual behavior, inappropriate touching in the workplace. There was a recent survey showing that in organizations, people by a factor of 3-1 think that rude, uncivil behavior is coming from people in positions of power. So it's easy to see evidence of the abuse of power. And I think that critically, one of the constraints upon abusive behavior is how our actions affect others. And powerful people don't pay enough attention to other people in their environment.
Mm-hmm. Tend to be just generally perhaps less given to compassion or concern about others.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's find out what our listeners think about all this. I mean, we're discussing this rather complex issue of power, the psychology of power, its effect on social and working lives. And we welcome your calls if you have some thoughts about this or questions you might want to pose to our researchers, our academic trio here. By all means, join us. And you can do that now toll-free wherever you're listening to us, or however, on the radio, the Internet, or the Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Again, your phone call is welcome, and our phone number, 866-733-6786. And I add again that that's toll-free. You can also email us any questions or comments you might have. The email address here is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. Talking with Deborah Gruenfeld, who is professor of organizational behavior and a social psychologist in the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. With Cameron Anderson, professor of organizational behavior and industrial relations at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, and Dr. Keltner, professor in the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're focusing this hour on power, the nature of power and its effect on relationships and on psychology. We're with Deborah Gruenfeld, who is in the Graduate School of Business at Stanford, and Dr. Keltner, who is in the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley, and Cameron Anderson, who's with the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. And Cameron Anderson, before we go to our callers and find out what's on their mind in this whole subject of power, what about those who think they have power? And I'm not talking necessarily about, you know, delusions of grandeur or anything mm-hmm. along those lines, but there are a lot of people who really feel I guess the word, the jargon word would be empowered, when they really don't have the power they think they have.
Right. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. So one of the interesting things that comes out of a lot of our work, actually, is just that in terms of the behavioral effects that we're talking about here, the disinhibiting effects and the focus on the positive aspects of one's environment and things like that, what it really boils down to is how powerful a person feels, much more so than how powerful they may actually be in the eyes of others. And so that idea actually led to another stream of research I'm working on now, where if there's a mismatch between a person's actual power and the power they think they have, what happens to their relationships with others and what happens to their general standing within a group? And I guess somewhat predictably, their general standing goes down. You know, their relationships start to erode. They start to be more disliked. They're seen as more obnoxious by others because they're simply going around, you know, barking out orders or giving unwanted advice or whatever it may be, which to many people can be one of the most aversive sort of social interactions they can have. So while at the same time, you know, we're finding all these effects being focused on the sense of power, a lot of research I'm doing now just basically shows that it's critical, socially speaking, to be pretty in tune with what your actual power is.
Well, let's find out what our callers have to say about this whole subject. Ping, you're first up here. Good morning and welcome to Forum.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Something I've always wondered about people in power is whether they wield power or acquire power with the intention, or at least in their own mind, of doing something that's good for others because they, you know, they feel they know what's right for other people, or they feel that, you know, things would be so much better for everyone if only things went, you know, a particular way, as opposed to doing so for selfish ends. And I wonder to what degree that's true, to what degree people delude themselves into thinking that's true, or they do so honestly, you know, for good reasons, and whether any of this research about how empathetic people are in the process of acquiring power, or how empathetic they are when they actually are in power, whether that sheds any light on the reasons people wield power.
It's a good question. Can power draw because of desire to be empathic or altruistic? Dr. Keltner, some thoughts on this?
Well, there are really two responses, and it's a great question. The first is, you know, our thinking is that power isn't inherently corrupting, that what it does is it takes your predisposition to engage in particular kinds of behaviors and then amplifies it. And so there are really neat studies showing that if you are a really altruistic, other-oriented person and you gain power, as our caller, the example that our caller brings to mind, that person becomes even more altruistic, right? So power amplifies your pre-existing tendencies. I would say, though, there's a reason. Cameron and I have done a bunch of research on who are the people that gravitate to positions of power and are nominated by their peers and their colleagues to have power very quickly. And there's a little bit of reason for worry because those are the people who tend to be inhibited and interested in self-interest to begin with. So power, if you have the right people who find positions of power, they do tend to be more empathetic and altruistic.
Let me thank Ping for that call and go to more of your calls. We'll go to Greg in San Jose. Morning, Greg.
Good morning. Thanks, Michael. I had an experience 2 weeks ago. I quit a job from a major corporation as one of six people leaving in a group of about 12, and part of it was the challenge with the manager with his power. And so I guess the question would be, you know, what sorts of things would you recommend that you could do in a situation like that to avoid having to change jobs for that one individual, and what sorts of other information that you might share?
Who would like to offer some advice to this?
Well,
Deborah Gruenfeld.
I don't know whether I can follow up on the question. I'm not sure I understood exactly what the issue is with what was with the person. Was the implication that the person was very disinhibited and abusive with their power?
Is that what you were saying, Greg? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the old idea is you fight power with power, right? But when you're powerless, it's hard to fight power with power.
Yeah. So there is some very direct research that bears very directly on this question, which is that, you know, the only way to sort of counteract this kind of situation is to correct the balance of power. And it's a difficult thing to do when you're working for someone who is ahead of you in the chain of command. But one of the sources of power that people fail to think about sometimes is that there's a lot of strength in numbers. So what we often recommend to people is that it's very difficult one-on-one to gain any leverage in this kind of relationship, but that by bonding together with other people who are also feeling disempowered and addressing this kind of difficult boss together, you can sometimes make progress, because it might be very easy for a boss to fire one of you, but it would be much more difficult to have to fire five or six. So it's, you can have a more impact.
Start a union.
Yeah, that kind of thing. That kind of thing, exactly.
Good luck to you, Greg, and thank you for the call. But on a one-on-one level, it becomes much more difficult.
Well, it's very difficult. And I think one of the things that research also shows is that, you know, we all conspire to create the social hierarchies that we're part of. It's not just that people with power take over the social situation, but in fact, consistent with what Cameron just said, we're all very sensitive to our place in the hierarchy. And when we sense that we're lower than someone else, we behave in ways that reinforce the nature of that relationship. So it's not one-sided. It's actually it's conspiratorial.
Julie, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Good
morning.
Yeah,
going along with this idea that it's conspiratorial, I've always felt that all power relationships scale up from the family, and that essentially people who seek power are people who felt powerless as children and are just looking for a chance to kind of to be the parent with the power, and that the real way to heal this or to address this is to, you know, is to change this on the family level and support families in a way that parents can be more present for children and not leave them feeling so powerless. And I'd like to hear the panel comment on that.
Well, let me go to the psychologist on this one, Dagger Keltner, because I'm reminded of all those human potential movement, things like transactional analysis. You know, we talk about the parent and the child and all
right.
of that. Everything was seen in terms of the family constellation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that there are a lot of nice studies coming out that show, as the caller anticipates, that when parents empower the child by engaging the child in reasoning about his or her life, that child has a greater sense of efficacy and power. So I think sort of on that note, the caller is right, and that the where there's a lot more power assertions from parent to child and authoritarian behavior, you see children who really seek the exploitation of power in their personal relationships. So I think she's spot on.
Yeah, and the teenage years, one has to cite as being perhaps in many ways the most formidable and challenging in the sense that we're talking about here, because I know things are happening endocrinologically, but there's also a desire to strike out on one's own by a teenager and to subvert that power. And yet at the same time, there's a desire to, in many instances, feel the comfort of it and the security of it. That's what makes teen years so tumultuous. I wonder, too, if the terrible twos, as they're called, you know, is really a kind of a power struggle, too. If something happens at certain age levels, certain chronological age levels, like teen years and terrible twos with power?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and it nicely, well, you know, if you study developmentally, a lot of the technicolor classic power displays of children start in the twos and threes, you know, the temper tantrums and the willful refusal to do just about everything. And that tracks developmental changes in self-representation, that children are getting a clear sense of who they are vis-a-vis other people. And remarkably, if you study the little daycare centers, there's the emergence of social hierarchies at that age. So it probably is very closely connected to the child's sense of a place in a hierarchy.
Testing the boundaries of the hierarchy, testing power, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? Charlie, you're on point here. Good morning. Welcome.
Great. Yeah, really enjoy the show. Thanks so much. I was reading Hubert Benoit's book on Zen and Transformation, and he really points to where we perceive authority, you know, in our teachers and our parents and perhaps heroes, artists, things like that, and how to kind of square that with the Buddhist thing of no man's head above your own. I mean, it's a practice, absolutely, because we often fall into the being in a room full of juniors and seniors rather than just being there.
I'm interested in your remark, Charlie, in terms of bringing up authority here. Where do authority and power come together, and where do they really separate from one another? I mean, do we have a sense of that? Any distinctive sense, Cameron Anderson?
Yeah, I guess the way we've thought about authority specifically is that it's one source of power among many. So in thinking about power as really the ability to influence others, it can stem from anything from one's role or position within a hierarchy, so that's really what authority is all about, or it can stem from more interpersonal skills, or it can stem from personality traits, or your membership within a powerful group. So with authority, I think the interesting thing about it is that it's not only sort of one source of power among many, but it has this sort of tinge of legitimacy to it, so that people will automatically sort of, I guess, defer to somebody based on their position, listen to what they say.
Or rebel against
them. Or rebel against them. That's right. That's right.
Let me go to more calls here, and we'll go next to caller in Tiburon. Chris, morning.
Oh, good morning. I'd like to jump in defense of Machiavelli for a moment. Machiavelli is usually understood to have said that it's better to be feared than loved for the prince, or better to be cruel than kind. But I think that's probably wrong. I think what Machiavelli was about was, depending on the situation, it might be better to be feared, or it might be better to be loved. Hmm. And the virtue of the prince is really in his emotional intelligence, in understanding what kind of action to take in a certain situation in order to achieve his end. And I was wondering if you guessed my comment.
Deborah Grunfeld.
I mean, I think that's a fair interpretation of one way of thinking about what emotional intelligence is. And I think this is consistent to some extent with the most popular notion that was really popularized by Goleman, that there's this notion that what emotional intelligence is about is knowing how to fit your own behavior to a particular kind of situation. I think what's different, where I would sort of draw the contrast between how Machiavelli thinks about power and how we think about it, is the notion that it's strategic by nature, and that the kinds of behaviors that we describe in our research are born of some kind of a strategy or a desire to have advantage. I think our sense about this is that, you know, the kinds of behavioral changes that we see in response to power are not strategic at all. So it's really kind of it's orthogonal to Machiavelli. Machiavelli, you know, makes a good point, and I think it's the case that to be successful with power, consistent with what we've said, you need to be very attentive to your social situation and know how to map your behavior onto it. I think what our research suggests is that people are just not really that good at that typically, and maybe that's why Machiavelli felt he needed to write that book, that people come into situations of power and they behave very impulsively based mostly on the signals they're getting from inside themselves with very little and not enough attention to what people on the outside would want.
But the focus with Machiavelli is on the ends, obviously. And what you're saying is perhaps the rightful distribution of power ought to be on the means.
That it's important to make the distinction between those two points. And I think our research is really consistent with this notion of the focus on ends and not means. I think our idea is that people with power couldn't be less concerned with means, right? It's all about sort of ends, and many of those ends are positive ends, but there's a kind of a unidimensional focus on attaining the end, and sometimes this leads to, you know, lack of empathy and also what we've described as objectification or using other people as a means.
Means justifying the ends, yeah. Tom, good morning. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Tom, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, hi.
One of the things that strikes me about power is that there are very real differences between power over, power to, and power with. And I use this in situations when I'm in power. I tend to aim for power with rather than trying to control people, trying to work with people to build something. And one comment on the drawing the E on the forehead, it's not drawing it so that the other people can't read it. It's drawing it so you can see it in a mirror.
Well, it would be if we'd had a mirror, but there was no mirror. So, yeah, that's right.
I like your distinctions with the prepositions, Tom, and thank you for that. Let me get more of your calls on here. We go to Lisa next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. I basically wanted to bring up the concept of the narcissistic personality, because it hasn't been talked about, and it appears as though, especially in terms of empathy, what they're really measuring is whether the particular person in power has a narcissistic personality or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they look in the mirror, they don't necessarily look at the E, right? They're just looking at themselves. Some thoughts on that from you, Decker Keltner, from narcissistic personality. I was going to the psychologist here, but Cameron Anderson, you want to step up here?
Well, sure. Yeah, I've done a couple studies involving narcissism. So, I guess what you could say is that for many of the effects that we're talking about, if the person is pretty high in narcissism, they just get exaggerated that much further. I mean, narcissism as a personality trait in and of itself just involves, well, self-involvement and sort of a preoccupation with success and demands for admiration. And so if you give someone like that a certain amount of power, they're going to use that in any way they can to satisfy their needs for admiration and respect and esteem.
However, having been acquainted through the years with some narcissists, I have found that some of them really have a self-image that they are compassionate, kind, altruistic, all of those sorts of things. And they can indeed act that way and behave that way as a result.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, so the behavior isn't rigidly self-involved. I mean, there are a lot of different variations in narcissism and different reasons for that people are narcissistic. So, no, I think that coincides with what we've done, yeah.
And we thank you, Lisa, and we go to Ron next in Oakland. Ron, you're on.
Yeah, question. Where does power and justice intersect? If I keep in consideration...
Well, you ask the easy questions, Ron.
If I keep in consideration what Socrates said, that power never harms another. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, we thank you. I remember that Socratic remark, but anybody want to jump in here? Yeah?
Decker? Well, it's a great question, and we've been thinking about it in terms of how people in positions of power, assuming, as our laboratory studies show, that they acquire a lot of the resources of public goods and the like. How do they rationalize this kind of behavior? And there are several studies that show that elevated power maps onto particular conceptions of justice, namely a preference for prioritizing individual rights, a preference for equity-based ideas of justice, that we get what we put into things as opposed to equality. So I think there's a clear connection between having a lot of power and then an ideology of a particular kind of justice.
How about when people feel powerless, particularly in the way justice is meted out or the way they are not receiving justice, or just in general, in human relationships for that matter? I mean, in many ways, it can be paralyzing, it can be immobilizing, impotence. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was one of the big questions that motivated this research from the outset, which is there is an amazing array of studies linking powerlessness in children on the grammar school playground and adults with a lot of unsettling social and physical outcomes. Depressed power is related to the increased incidence of anxiety disorders and depression and health problems and the like. And so that was an intellectual inspiration for our theory, which is to think about what is it about not having power that leads to these kind of problems or these correlates.
Again, Dacher Keltner is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, and Diana is calling us from Oakland. Morning, Diana.
Oh, yes. Hello. Thank you for this forum. It's so fascinating. You know, I tuned in late, and I think I got at the butt end of how, depending upon in what order you were born, who has the power or perceived power. And I want to talk about the kind of dichotomy or irony of, like, I have a sister who, I mean, we're middle age now, but she still thinks that she rules the roost, you know, in terms of, well, she'll always be the older sister, and that's just that. And although I think she thinks she has power, I also think that underneath that, or I'm wondering what your panel would say about this, underneath that there's a feeling of helplessness unless she can control every aspect of her environment.
It's called control freakishness.
Yes, and when you mention narcissism, I'm there like, ding, 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 you know, kind of like my whole family, and I'm the younger one.
Are you looking for ways to disempower her, or what are you
looking for? You know, not even disempower her. We don't even have a relationship, and it really saddens me because it's just sad. I mean, I've tried to, like, she'll, in short, she'll express herself however she does, and then when I try to, I'm cut off, and then when I write to express myself, because I just, that's me, I have to get it out, and I also feel like, hey, I'm an equal here, I get to express myself, and it's just thought of as, like, you know, preposterous, how dare I, like, stick up for myself sort of reaction, and, you know, since high school, we have not had any sort of what you could call relationship.
I don't know if we can really give you useful advice here because, you know, every dynamic with siblings has its own nuances and all that. But in a general sense, when somebody is feeling the way Diana is feeling, do any of you have any practical advice?
I have a thought about it, which Deborah is, Grunthal. You know, part of what you're describing, I'm sure, has to do with characteristics that are attributable to your sister and the dynamic between you and her. But it's important to remember, we haven't talked about that too much today, that we think of power really as a characteristic of a relationship, not a characteristic of a person, right? So I suspect that part of what's going on there is that there is this hierarchy in your family, and it may be the case that nobody likes it. But if I had to guess, I would say somehow you're enabling her to maintain the position that she has. Consistent with what I said before, and this is not to point out dysfunction at all, but just to say this is how hierarchy works, that nobody can claim power and status for themselves. It has to be given to them by other people. So my sense is that it's not an easy solution, but it probably would have to involve everyone in the family just looking at what the hierarchy is and what kinds of behaviors are reinforcing it.
And let me thank Diana for her call. What do we know, I mentioned Foucault before, Dacher Keltner, about the relationship between power and sex? Obviously, it's a very strong dynamic.
Yeah, there are several studies out there showing that, first of all, if you look at the non-human literature and the primate literature, elevated positions in hierarchies are correlated with sexual behavior extremely high, and the number of offspring that you have, it's a very powerful relationship. If you take it to humans, we're an interesting primate because we look a little bit more like birds than other primates in that we're parabonders and monogamous, and we don't tend to, alpha males and females don't rule the roost, so to speak, in sexual behavior. But what we do know is if you give people power, they are more likely to engage in disinhibited sexual behavior. They come on inappropriately in the lab room. We've done studies showing that strangers who have power will flirt inappropriately and attribute sexual desire to their partner when that person doesn't feel it. So there's a pretty strong relationship.
I get that, but I guess I was thinking more about the convergence of the two. Mm-hmm. You know, some people obviously get excited about the idea of being dominant and tying someone up and, you know, doing those kinds of things. Well, no, I mean, this is, you know, opening up maybe a Pandora's box a little bit, but it certainly seems to be a distinct proportion of the population who seem to enjoy that kind of thing. You know?
Right. I may give you an unsatisfying and abstract answer here, but, you know, what we think is that power makes a lot of goal-directed behavior more likely, sexual behavior, eating behavior, aggressive behavior. And that occurs at the neurological level. So it would be fitting with our thinking that as you gain in power, you are experiencing those impulses in a more acute way.
Ben, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. Professor Grunfeld, I was actually a student of yours a number of years ago at the business school, and I was fascinated by the Milgram experiment.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask a question about the role of morality and power. I was frustrated in the business school because they often talk morality in the context of consequences. So a manager makes an immoral decision and they end up paying the price later, rather than in the context of morality for morality's sake.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you could talk about the role of morality and power aside from consequence, but in terms of how people show moral behavior in power charge dynamics.
I can try. I don't know. This is an area that's, I think, a little bit outside my expertise. The only way I really know how to respond to it is to say that, you know, again, consistent with what Dacher said a few minutes ago, that, you know, I don't think that power is necessarily linked to moral or immoral behavior, that we are who we are and we have the values and morals that we have as individuals. And what we think power does is basically free people to act on their values in very direct ways. So I think, you know, if you, for example, power is what would account, I would argue, for many of the examples of the most visible and historically important examples of morality we've seen exhibited, right? That people need to feel a sense of power, and to the extent that they actually have power, they're better able to make an impact. But I don't know of any work personally that shows a direct link between power and morality per se. I don't know if my colleagues have any other thoughts.
Yeah, Cameron,
about that.
You want to jump in here, Cameron Anderson?
Well, I guess I was nodding because I came across some work recently that there's this sort of general lay theories out there in the population that power is linked with immoral behavior, that we have this model of powerful people as being corrupt and is behaving in immoral ways. And it was more of a theory piece. Theorists was basically arguing that could in turn contribute to immoral behavior among the powerful. So if you think that's what powerful people do, you end up in a powerful position, voila, you start enacting the role that you think you're supposed to be enacting.
Well, if Lord Acton is right,
that's
power
right.
corrupts.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah. Let me thank the caller, and on we go. We go to Sebastopol. Daniel, morning.
Yeah, I think there's three distinct types of power, and I think it would be useful to distinguish between them. A lot of the research that you're talking about is about institutional authority or power over others, what Tom is calling power over. And that is based on an external form of control or you know, access to resources. But there's two other kinds that I think are very different. One is the power that comes from recognition from others, individually or a group. If people admire someone or look to them as a model, they have moral integrity, leadership qualities. And that's what we often see in primates, someone who actually serves others or the community. It's a service-based. And then the third one is power from within, the inherent power we each have, which rather than being a zero sum as power over, the power that we have within ourselves when we work together is additive or cumulative, like in unions. And so the difference between institutional authority or power as a form of service or collective action is important. And I just wondered if your guests could comment on that.
I'll take a stab.
Cameron Anderson.
Yeah, so there's some work that speaks to this issue, actually. I guess the bottom line or the quick takeaway from it is that while a lot of the effects that we're talking about cut across different forms of power, there are some forms of power where you don't see as many, say, profligate behaviors or the disinhibited behaviors. And one of them is if power does stem from, I guess, what he's referring to as status or prestige or being held in high esteem in the eyes of others. I think there can be more checks on that type of power because the very source of your power is the collective esteem for this individual. So if that individual starts behaving in ways that that the collective deems inappropriate or unethical or immoral, then they have the sort of authority or they have the collective will to depose them.
Well, there's a kind of moral capital maybe that you're talking about here.
Exactly.
That doesn't necessarily have institutional power behind it.
That's right.
That's right. Power may not even be power, but that's a whole other subject for discussion perhaps. I want to thank you all, though, for what I thought was a fascinating hour. We talked about power this hour with Deborah Grunfeld, again, professor of organizational behavior and social psychologist in the Graduate School of Business at Stanford, Cameron Anderson, professor of organizational behavior and industrial relations at the Haas School of Business, UC Berkeley, and Dacher Keltner, professor in the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley. We want to thank all of you, our listeners, whom we are grateful for. We're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back with you on tomorrow if all goes according to plan. We want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, Sharon Adam. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.